wrote the book, Why We Hate the Oil Company, Straight Talk from an Energy Insider, because this nation has for too long not had a sufficiently robust energy strategy to move us clearly into the 21st century, where our competitiveness, our national security, our lifestyles, etc., are all at risk if we don't have ample energy to support what we do in this country well into and through the 21st century. We're living off the legacy of a brilliant energy infrastructure that was built between the 1920s and the 1970s. And we've largely lived off of it for the last 40 years successfully, but now it's old and now it's in decline. And if we don't get our act together in terms of what sources of energy will guide the nation forward over the next 50 years, we will see our country lose its competitive edge. Lifestyles will be impacted. And in my book, I say that if we stay on our current path, within 10 years, we will face an energy abyss like we've never seen in our history.
The necessity of losing the excess energy that cannot be used for a system's growth. At first sight, it is easy to recognize in the economy, in the production and use of wealth, a particular aspect of terrestrial activity regarded as a cosmic phenomenon. A movement is produced on the surface of the globe that results from the circulation of energy at this point in the universe. The economic activity of men appropriates this movement, making use of the resulting possibilities for certain ends. But this movement has a pattern and laws with which, as a rule, those who use them and depend on them are unacquainted. Thus, the question arises, is the general determination of energy circulating in the biosphere altered by man's activity? Or rather, isn't the latter's intention vitiated by a determination of which it is ignorant, which it overlooks and cannot change? Without waiting, I will give an inescapable answer. Man's disregard for the material basis of his life still causes him to err in a serious way. Humanity exploits given material resources, but by restricting them, as it does, to a resolution of the immediate difficulties it encounters, a resolution which it has hastily had to define as an ideal, it assigns to the forces it employs an end which they cannot have. Beyond our immediate ends, man's activities, in fact, pursues the useless and infinite fulfillment of the universe. Of course, the error that results from so complete a disregard does not just concern man's claim to lucidity. It is not easy to realize one's own ends if one must, in trying to do so, carry out a movement that surpasses them. No doubt these ends and this movement may not be entirely irreconcilable. But if these two terms are not to be reconciled, we must cease to ignore one of them. Otherwise, our work quickly turns to catastrophe. I will begin with a basic fact. The living organism, in a situation determined by the play of energy on the surface of the globe, ordinarily receives more energy than is necessary for maintaining life. The excess energy, wealth, can be used for the growth of a system, e.g., an organism. If the system can no longer grow, or if the excess cannot be completely absorbed in its growth, it must necessarily be lost without profit. It must be spent willingly or not, gloriously or catastrophically.
Up until the day this occurred, it was the policy of multiple administrations and whole programmatic efforts at the Department of Energy to induce the oil industry to be in the ultra deep. Okay, we as taxpayers were funding that push out into the deep. And so make no mistake, blowouts happen in the oil industry. It's not an infrequent occurrence per se, it's just much easier to deal with on dry land. Okay, and it's much easier to deal with in the shallows. But when you're talking about, for example, the exercise they now have in front of them of, you know, putting a straw down 2 miles to hit something the size of a dinner plate, okay, this is tricky stuff with a young guy working a joystick back in Houston, You know, with I mean, you probably tried things in your swimming pool or at Six Flags before moving things around the water isn't easy. Moving around the water a mile down and then going into the exercise we got, this is very tricky, pushing the envelope, engineering for the cure. And it was tricky engineering to get this far. So what's the future of that? It's robust, but not necessarily in our country or in our waters, which is a scary concept to me as a person who's has a conviction for global conservation, because these rigs, we're not killing off the golden goose, we're just scaring them away. And so we were the ones most intent on regulating and evolving the science and technology for the ultra deep. Now you will see those rigs ultimately end up somewhere off the coast of West Africa or Brazil or somewhere else. Those assets will be monetized. The spill rates there have historically been much greater. The accident rates that we don't report on every day there are much greater. They will affect the global ecosystem. And so we've really got to get to the lessons learned phase quickly, because we're not going to erase ultra-deep drilling. We're going to need the oil. It's part of our incumbency right now.
The poverty of organisms or limited systems and the excess wealth of living nature. Minds accustomed to seeing the development of productive forces as the ideal end of activity refuse to recognize that energy, which constitutes wealth, must ultimately be spent lavishly without return, and that a series of profitable operations has absolutely no other effect than the squandering of profits. To affirm that it is necessary to dissipate a substantial portion of energy produced, sending it up in smoke, is to go against judgments that form the basis of a rational economy. We know cases where wealth has had to be destroyed, coffee thrown into the sea, but these scandals cannot reasonably be offered as examples to follow. They are the acknowledgement of an impotence, and no one could find in them the image and essence of wealth. Indeed, involuntary destruction, such as the disposal of coffee overboard, has in every case the meaning of failure. It is experienced as a misfortune. In no way can it be presented as desirable. And yet, it is the type of operation without which there is no solution. When one considers the totality of productive wealth on the surface of the globe, it is evident that the products of this wealth can be employed for productive ends only insofar as the living organism that is economic mankind can increase its equipment. This is not entirely, neither always nor indefinitely, possible. A surplus must be dissipated through deficit operations. The final dissipation cannot fail to carry out the movement that animates terrestrial energy. The contrary usually appears for the reason that the economy is never considered in general. The human mind reduces operations in science as in life to an entity based on typically particular systems, organisms, or enterprises. Economic activity, considered as a whole, is conceived in terms of a particular operations with limited ends. The mind generalizes by composing the aggregate of these operations. Economic science merely generalizes the isolated situation. It restricts its object to operations carried out with a view to a limited end, that of economic man, and does not take into consideration a play of energy that no particular end limits. The play of living matter in general involved in the movement of light, of which it is the result. On the surface of the globe, for living matter in general, energy is always in excess. The question is always posed in terms of extravagance. The choice is limited to how the wealth is to be squandered. It is to the particular living being, or to limited populations of living beings, that the problem of necessity presents itself. But man is not just the separate being that contends with the living world and with other men for his share of resources. The general movement of exudation, of waste, of living matter impels him, and he cannot stop it. Moreover, being at the summit, his sovereignty in the living world identifies him with this movement. It destines him, in a privileged way, to that glorious operation, to useless consumption. If he denies this, as he is constantly urged to do by the consciousness of a necessity, of an indigence inherent in separate beings, which are constantly short of resources, which are nothing but eternally needy individuals, his denial does not alter the global movement of energy in the least. The latter cannot accumulate limitlessly in the productive forces. Eventually, like a river into the sea, it is bound to escape us and be lost to us.
But here's the outcome of that. In 2010, you won't see the gas price move much because there's plenty of supply in the marketplace. We'll probably be at or about this gas price for most of this year. But those wells that were being shut in by the president in the deep water, a year and a half from now, will result in 100 to 150,000 barrels a day of non-production that was counted on for our domestic marketplace. 3 years out, it's close to 500,000 barrels a day that will not be being produced in this domestic market, unless we revert that decision very quickly and get those rigs back into operation. The consequence, by middle of 2012, with any kind of economic recovery, is the American consumer will see gasoline prices skyrocketing, which will lead to the exact opposite reality that we experience today, and we'll be right back to drill, baby, drill. Because millions and millions of people will protest $5 gasoline, and they won't understand why the price has gotten so high.
In our time, the relative importance of armed conflicts has even increased. It has taken on the disastrous proportions of which we are aware. Recent history is the result of the soaring growth of industrial activity. At first, this prolific movement restrained martial activity by absorbing the main part of the excess. The development of modern industry yielded the period of relative peace from 1815 to 1914. Developing in this way, increasing the resources, the productive forces made possible in the same period the rapid demographic expansion of the advanced countries, this is the fleshly aspect of the bony proliferation of the factories. But in the long run, the growth that the technical changes made possible became difficult to sustain. It became productive of an increased surplus itself. The First World War broke out because its limits were really reached, even locally. The second did not itself signify that the system could not develop further, either extensively or in any case intensively. But it weighed the possibilities of a halt in development and ceased to enjoy the opportunities of growth that nothing opposed. It is sometimes denied that the industrial plethora was at the origin of these recent wars, particularly the first. Yet it was this plethora that both wars exuded. Its size was what gave them their extraordinary intensity. Consequently, the general principle of an excess of energy to be expended, considered beyond the too narrow scope of the economy, as the effect of a movement that surpasses it, tragically illuminates a set of facts. Moreover, it takes on a significance that no one can deny. We can express the hope of avoiding a war that already threatens. But in order to do so, we must divert the surplus production either into the rational extension of a difficult industrial growth or into unproductive works that will dissipate an energy that cannot be accumulated in any case. This raises numerous problems, which are exhaustingly complex. One can be skeptical of arriving easily at the practical solutions they demand, but the interest they hold is unquestionable. I will simply state, without waiting further, that the extension of economic growth itself requires the overturning of economic principles, the overturning of the ethics that grounds them. Changing from the perspectives of restrictive economy to those of general economy actually accomplishes a Copernican transformation, a reversal of thinking and of ethics. If a part of wealth, subject to a rough estimate, is doomed to destruction, or at least to unproductive use without any possible profit, it is logical, even inescapable, to surrender commodities without return. Henceforth, leaving aside pure and simple dissipation, analogous to the construction of the pyramids, the possibility of pursuing growth is itself subordinated to giving. The industrial development of the entire world demands of Americas that they lucidly grasp the necessity for an economy such as theirs of having a margin of profitless operations. An immense industrial network cannot be managed in the same way that one manages a tire. It expresses a circuit of cosmic energy on which it depends, which it cannot limit, and whose laws it cannot ignore without consequences. Woe to those who, to the very end, insist on regulating the movement that exceeds them with the narrow mind of the mechanic who changes a tire.
I think the chronic underestimation of the American people's understanding and perception of the corrosive nature of oil on our economic and geopolitical position is a short-term mistake in this town. And it doesn't belong to any one party. It's the chronic thing that says we can't deal with a price signal because that's just too politically risky. So we will keep having this increasing volatility and endure price premiums, like John just talked about, that are inevitable in this global supply and demand, with all the inevitable consequences of excess debt and borrowing that is necessary to send dollars abroad that inevitably gets in the hands of people that we have to confront. We're going through that cycle with greater volatility and variation and shorter iterations. And at some point, the American people will just say, I've got enough. We're done with the 30-year cycle. We really have to understand, are we going to get a price signal with forethought and planning, or are we going to do it only on the back of reactive pain with other people controlling the high price? That is our choice.